Hi, Internet. My name is Jonathan Matos.
And this is Melissa Matos.
I'm the writer of Cain and Abel, and other sad and suspenseful stories based on the tragic heroes of Scripture.
I like how he's got this perfect spiel. I have a spiel, but I haven't memorized it yet. But
strong,
I write...
Strong, fierce, wild.
Yes, that. Strong, fierce, wild female protagonist in fantasy and science fiction.
Yes.
On Montos.com.
This is a unboxing story. When we unpack our feels about fringe fiction. I heard a bunch of stuff about Robert Mault. How I kind of came to this topic was through a movie that came out a couple years ago that was about somebody that got lost looking for the lost city of Zed.
Okay. Is that like one of the golden cities or something?
I think if it's not that, it's a very similar thing in like South America.
Yeah.
And so the reviewer, Brad Jones, was saying that like it reminded him of The Mission, which is Robert Bolt John. So it made me want to look up other stuff that Robert Bolt did. Lo and behold, he's the guy that did Lawrence of Arabia and The Man for All Seasons. And Dr. Zhivago. And it's an interesting thing because screenwriters, we've done a couple of screenwriter spotlights. We did Guillermo del Toro.
Shyamalan.
And it's not very often that you know a movie by the screenwriter. What were your first, like, blushes at learning about Lawrence of Arabia? Like, how did you discover it?
So, I knew it was a classic. Mm-hmm. I knew Laurence Olivier was in it. I knew it was really long. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't really had any desire to see it.
Mm-hmm.
On my own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that my perception of it is kind of like, I've been thinking about this with a lot of the art house trailers that I've seen recently. Like, a good example is the Lucy in the Sky trailer, where a lot of them don't really get to what the conflict of the story is. And so with Lawrence of Arabia, I always just do, it's in the desert.
Yeah.
And I was just like, well.
Yeah, so what?
Like, I don't know the, I hadn't seen anything else with Laurence Olivier.
Oh, that's a shame. We need to fix that.
So I didn't really have any, like, okay, Laurence Olivier in the desert. And, you know, he didn't grow up watching, well, maybe he did. It depends. At what time did all those spaghetti westerns and
that's a good question.
Well, there's a clacky clacks. He used to watch a lot of John Wayne movies. And so seeing Lawrence of Arabia as a image in my subconscious, I kind of thought of it as like, oh, it's another one of those things where it's just one man against the odds. And I thought going into it that it was going to be this, manifest destiny thing. This white man's going to come in and teach all the brown people how to do their stuff.
Right.
You know.
It looks like it was the 60s.
Okay. Yeah, so generally, what's interesting, I think, like, going into how we've started to view some of the pictures in this time, we watched, what was the one with Dustin Hoffman?
Little Big Man.
Little Big Man. So, like, that one is much more like a drama comedy that has a lot of, like, you know, this was a super messed up time and a lot of messed up stuff happened. And it didn't necessarily seem like, Dustin Hoffman was that big machismo guy that's going to come in and, like, it was trying to make a point that he was going to change the Indians' way of life, you know, like that type of thing. So I got the sense that during the 60s and 70s, there were big, epic 40s Hollywood extravaganzas, and then there were starting to be, like, you know, different things that commented on those movies, but didn't necessarily continue that tradition of stuff. But what were your initial reactions to the movie?
So, it did have a very slow start, and I was expecting that anyway. I was expecting long stretches of, isn't this amazing, beautiful scenery, and look at this amazing, creepy desert, etc. But the scenes where you actually get conversation and the drama between characters was really good.
Right.
I really enjoyed the dialogue. I really enjoyed the drama that was brought up. I really enjoyed the characters. I thought they were well written and very fully developed.
Yeah, I really liked the dialogue. So many of those things are from the 60s and before are difficult to watch because of how, like, and then I will do this and everything will be fine.
Yeah.
Like, there's still that theatrical influence to it. And that's one thing I was reading. The Independent, a British website was saying that his dialogue was much more naturalistic. Like, specifically, there's a scene where after, you know, helping, excuse me, the Turks get this really major, or not the Turks, helping the nomads, the Bedouins, what the English call them, getting them to fight the Turks, and they have this major victory, and he comes back wearing, you know, the clothes of the Bedouins and being, like, significantly, like, sunburnt and, you know, demanding, like, I just want a cup of lemonade.
Yeah.
And then he sits down with the new commander who, like, you get slowly through the scene that, like, you know, he's happy that that old, like, they didn't really make much of a thing in the beginning that, like, oh, this is, like, for, that's another whole thing, but he sees that this general, he's, like, okay with the commands that he gets. But then when he comes back, somebody tells him there's a new guy, and he's like, oh, thank God.
Yeah.
And then he sits with him, and out of nowhere, the commander's like, can I try that hat? And that's a, it's a very subtle way of showing that, like, this guy doesn't want to conquer the, you know, Middle East. Like, he's
not.
Right. And that kind of subtlety is kind of not what I was, you know, expecting in the movie. That being
although
said,
we were commenting that it's really difficult watching Alec Guinness in that outfit in the desert and not expect, like, Jawas to pop up over
right.
the distant sand dunes.
All right, so that's a good way to broach another topic. But I was going to say that there's still that sense of, like, grandeur that, because it's not in many films. Like, I think J.J. Abrams tried to capture that in Force Awakens, where there's big musical stingers and there's a little bit more time spent with different scenes to build, like, character and build, you know, in some cases, suspense. And so that there's different things that he's trying to, like, directly tie to the original Star Wars film, so being in the late 70s, you know, he's trying to do those things, and the, you know, the screen
the
wipes
screen
and
wipes, yeah.
Stuff like that. But the, yeah, you broached a topic that's going to be a little difficult because of all the stuff recently about blackface in this time period.
They did at least cast Omar Sharif as one of the major Bedouin characters.
Mm-hmm.
Who is actually Egyptian.
Right, because that's another thing.
From North Africa.
For those of you who haven't watched spaghetti westerns, a big thing that they would do is have Italians play Mexicans or, you know, sometimes if it's like a jungle movie, they'd have, you know, Mexicans play.
Right,
Africans.
Something weird.
And so, like, you know, all.
But like, here you're brownish, go play that.
Right, book. Yeah. So the. If you're aware of that history, it wasn't necessarily like it is now, where they're specifically trying to give underrepresented voices in film an opportunity to actually tell the stories that they're, you know, a part of. So Omar Sharif, it's interesting because he plays kind of like a tertiary role in this. Still very prominent, but I think in terms of billing, he'd probably be third next to Alec Guinness and Laurence Olivier. He gets more screen time than Alec Guinness does, to be fair. But Omar Sharif was actually the lead in Dr. Zhivago. And I'll see if I can go into that a little bit later. It's not as much. The general topic of this is talking about how British and Americans write, other voices. I thought that the idea of Olivier and, you know, the comparisons to Zhivago showed to me that this was kind of common in Robert Bolt's scripts, is that he's trying to write a character that isn't just committed to his nation. Like, there's a line within the text of Lawrence of Arabia where Lawrence says, "I love Britain, but I also love other things."
Right.
And he doesn't want I don't know if you would call him a sheik.
Right.
He doesn't want
he was a prince, they were calling him.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, yeah.
He doesn't want him to think, "I'm trying to help you defeat the Turks so that the British
can take over you."
You know, yeah, just march in and...
He was trying to get the British to promise not to come in and try and take Arabia.
And there's also all that little cultural things where, like, they still want to fight with on horseback with swords.
Right.
And because the Turks have guns, the British commander is trying to convince Alec Guinness's character, the Sheik, to just forget their military strengths of, like, you know, thousands of years and, you know, reform to
become
the
British,
you know.
Become basically a unit for the British.
Mm-hmm.
And then Lawrence is like, "That's dumb. These people can get across the desert in ways none of the rest of us can.
Mm-hmm.
We should take advantage of that and let them fight the way they know how to fight."
Right.
And let them be who they are, you know, like, it was, and yeah, it was interesting. Not what I was expecting it to be, really.
The downside is that we've rented it twice in a row.
And still haven't finished it.
And still haven't finished it.
Because we still have, an hour left on it?
The movie is 3 hours and 45 minutes.
Yes.
Which is longer even than Lord of the Rings.
Well, some of them.
Well, my sister
has
the extended
versions.
So.
But if it would have been greatly reduced if they didn't, you know, have giant sweeping, you know, panoramic views of the desert with grandiose music playing in the background. It's like,
right.
Just get to, we know they're crossing a desert. Can we just get to the next scene, please? Although it did give you the sense of, you know, this isn't just any desert. This is like some huge, scary, scary, terrifying desert that nobody wants to cross. So there's that.
But you were saying that the directing was just like, okay, we understand.
Yeah, like I don't really see a lot of direction coming from the director of whatever this film is.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because he actually has amazing actors,
mm-hmm,
who could have done those parts in their sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, I think that's the interesting thing about film is that when you're a screenwriter, or at least starting out, you might assume, hey, you know, I write this thing and they're going to follow it by the letter. Normally, the director and the actors and the producers all work to make it the most sellable product that they can make. And so from the writing perspective, it's kind of like they're reducing, you know, my amazing, you know, vision of what I wanted to do. Now, the director's job is to try to translate that into a visual thing. So I think what's interesting is that I was assuming that the tactic that would be used is let's let Lawrence and Omar Sharif and Alec Guinness eat up the screen with their big, amazing, you know, whether it's like action scenes or big speeches or something. But I did appreciate some of the craft in terms of like when it's getting hot, like you can tell based on how the crackling of the background is that like they're really in a desert.
Yeah.
And that like
yeah.
You know, it tried to get you to feel like you're there with them.
And I do appreciate that they didn't have a lot of big grandiose speeches. Like it wasn't you know, okay, this is Lawrence's big inspirational speech. Everything that they did was shown through dialogue. It was really pretty well done, that part. I mean, I think it was really well written. Like I said, it's just
It didn't need to be 3 hours and 45 minutes. It could have been like at least just like three hours.
Two and a half.
yeah, because most movies nowadays clock in at an hour 30, and it's very rare that you get something like,
you know,
Lord of the Rings that's 3 hours long. We're starting to get that now more with Endgame and
yeah, with the bigger things. But
yeah, it's like when the studios know that you're gonna sit your butt down and you know have like a little pee container or something to make sure that you don't have to run in and out. Then they'll put that in theaters. But if they're not sure that you're gonna, you know, not just run home and give a 1-star Fandango review,
yeah.
Because you're just like, oh, I can't sit that long.
Nope.
apologies to our Southern viewers. That wasn't a that wasn't really sensitive. On that point, we listened to another, or not listened to, we read Sun and Shadow by Ray Bradbury, one of my favorite authors. Fahrenheit 451 is my jam. I've reread it now, I think maybe 3 times.
Oh, wow.
Really like his voice. I think it's really visceral. Like you get a lot of the points that he's trying to make because of how vivid his imagery is and the worlds that he creates. And it's interesting because he's usually known as a sci-fi writer, but this is one of the only literary short stories that I've seen from him. And that the premise is that it's set in Mexico, where outside Ricardo's window, there's a photographer and a model that, without his permission, are just, you know, set up shop, and they're snapping pictures
with his son as part of the background.
Right. And so what we're getting here is commentary about appropriation from a white writer.
Yeah.
And so I think I really like the humor, like the idea of how Ricardo chooses to deal with it after, you know, trying to be polite and saying like, listen, this isn't right. Like,
yeah,
my house is not, you know,
it's not your studio.
My house
is not a background.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my house wasn't made to look all dingy and dirty so that you could, you know, show off the fanciness of your clothes. Like, I think that there's a lot of interesting stuff that he says with that, just with that character yelling at the photographer, you know, about like, A, you know, you're using my culture as your backdrop for your fancy magazine pictures.
Mm-hmm.
You're using my son and the fact that I am poor and what that looks like as though it is some scenery.
Yeah.
You know?
Just using it as an object for your, you know, for your benefit.
For your marketing techniques. Like, what are you doing?
And so that what Ricardo chooses to do is rather than like be aggressive about it, he just stands there and is like, okay. And he's like, I'll be part of your pictures. And when he goes to snap a photo, he drops his pants. and then it kind of escalates where he, you know, they try to move somewhere else and he still does it.
And then look at the cops. But the cop is his friend.
Yeah.
And the cop's like, well,
he's not
just
doing
standing
anything
there.
Lewd.
It's like, but he's naked. It's like, but he's just standing there. Like, he's not doing anything that's bothering anybody.
Mm-hmm. and then they decide to leave. And he, you know, he asks them to just, like, go home.
Yeah, go to another country. Go to Spain or France or somewhere else.
but if you, you know, wherever you go, I'm going to be there. And then it gets to the point where he, like, pulls his pants back up. There's this kind of, like, you know, inner, or there's omniscient kind of monologue where, you know, it's talking about the, you know, sanctity of the self and all this stuff. And then they, all of a sudden, like, once he pulls up his pants, he realizes everybody's, you know, watching him and they're all clapping for him. So I think that you know, Marxist reading of this would probably say that, like, anything that is capitalist that is done is inherently, like, you know, evil and wrong. And so to hold Ray Bradbury to that and say, well, you're writing about, you know, something, you're benefiting from this, and these people don't have a say, I would argue that, like, as has been part of our parlance, you know, we're doing something, we're getting sponsored in a podcast to talk about other people's stories, and the inherent wrongness of being a part of the conversation, I don't really side with that thing. But at the same time, I appreciate when people like, for example, the Schmoes Know Movie Show try to include minorities as much as possible and keep those gates open and have an awareness that these people are as creative as you are. And just because somebody is different than you doesn't mean that, you know, they don't have anything to say about the, you know, Western culture and stuff like that.
Right. And it's such a, I was just trying to think of how to address it. It's such a difficult thing because there are so many interesting cultures in the world and you want to tell stories about them.
Mm.
And some of us find telling stories about our everyday life, my culture, boring, which is why I write fantasy stories, because I'm like, nobody wants to hear about my boring life. So, you know, you want to try and incorporate other culture stuff. You want to show that you admire other cultures or show that you, like, I was going to bring up Dances with Wolves as another example of this, especially, like, with Lawrence of Arabia, where it's not just a white guy comes in and appreciates this other culture and is trying to help them, but, like, eventually naturalizes into them as sort of this, like, well, you guys have a better life than we do.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of homage to this other culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it does sometimes come across as like being what they call it, the white savior syndrome thing, where it's this white guy that shows up and is trying to save their culture. It's like, that's not really what either of those stories is trying to do, but I can see how that can come across badly because, you know, why is it going to be about the white guy?
Mm-hmm.
Like, why do you only see my culture in reference to you?
Mm-hmm.
But being from the other culture, it's kind of like, well, I can't see it from your point of view because I'm not you guys either. Like, how do we go about this?
Mm.
But anyway, in the case of Native Americans, it's also a very much like we feel horrible for what happened to them.
Mm.
But, you know, how do you approach those sorts of stories and not have it sound like either A, you're making them look like perfect people and like, you know, how dare we touch the sanctity of their existence, but at the same time, you don't want to make it all look like, well, we're these, you know, superior colonial force that came through and they just were gonna get lost in the mess anyway.
Right.
I don't know. It's such a huge,
but I
ball of yarn worm. I don't know problems.
Yeah, I think that there are people that reduce the argument to their peril. And I'll leave that at that. But one person that I really deeply respect as a writer, James Baldwin, was talking about this with the movie The Defiant Ones. And he was saying that there's these two, a black and a white prisoner, and initially they hate each other, and then when it comes time for them to jump off a train, the Sidney Poitier jumps off so that the other guy can get freed. You know, I don't know the specifics of it, but his critique of it was that it was part of what common parlance calls racial forgiveness. And I think that there are certainly aspects of certain stories where if somebody commits a heinous act, and just because they're white and they do a thing like, you know, if somebody commits a hate crime, for example, in Act 1, and then in Act 3, they save a black baby. Like, that doesn't mean that hate crimes are good.
Right.
You know, and the idea that, you know, it's a difficult thing because, you know, writing is this subtle thing where you're not trying to necessarily always create direct propaganda, like in the case of the Nazis or you know, certain movies financed by the U.S. military or whatever. But in a sense, you are making some kind of commentary if you're choosing to have somebody who is overtly racist and then, you know, is somehow redeemed just through one act of kindness or some such. For more specific examples of, you know, discussing race, you can check out our last podcast on Native Son. Definitely get more examples of, you know, ideologies and how difficult it is to deal with some of those. I think this will be a short episode. I don't really see anything more that
I was going to really briefly bring up the concept. So is cultural appropriation usually something only ever referred to when it's white people dealing with non-white people? Like if we were to culturally appropriate something from Russia or, you know, Sweden.
Okay. The common association is a oppressor-oppressed thing. So if there was a situation, like...
I just wondered if it was ever used in that context. I haven't heard it that way, but it's usually, it's like a, like you were saying, either oppressor-oppressed or, you know, majority versus minority.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because the idea is that there's some kind, it's like the power difference is what makes it.
It was what makes it wrong.
Makes it, you know, yeah, difficult to forgive because it's, the idea is that you're.
I mean, I would still consider it insensitive, like when people randomly dress up in like German Lederhosen when they're not, and they're just going to like Oktoberfest dressed like that because that's the funny thing to do. I still think that's weird. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't necessarily think it's a nice thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't necessarily be as offended as blackface or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Right, because, yeah, because and that's the other half of it. So there's the oppressor-oppressed thing. Excuse me. And then there's the idea of a historical association
with something
a certain type of thing. So, like, you know, the minstrel show is being something that reduces black people to a specific image, and so, you know, you don't do that now because it's associated with that. And even though Americans don't necessarily treat blacks in terms of U.S. policy having changed that in terms of the written law, you know, it's much more, there's many more cases of societal racism, just like social, and that's where the idea of social justice comes from. Interesting movies, interesting short story. If you want to check it out, you can do that.
It's and a fun after little the, short story.
After the bump, we'll tell you where you can find us. Oh, yeah, I forget that it defaults to the right mic.
Yes.
If you want to watch, by the way, any of Robert Bolt stuff, I would highly suggest watching Dr. Zhivago on Netflix. Number one, if you're subscribed to Netflix, which pretty much everybody is, you can avoid paying for it. And number two, it's much, I think, easier to get into
Then Lawrence of Arabia.
Lawrence of Arabia, which is 99 minutes of desert and
yes, at least
40 minutes of
dialogue. Really good dialogue, granted.
Where can they find Mom Toast stuff?
MomToast.com.
Yes.
Sign up for the newsletter and you will get reminded of my stuff on MomToast.com. You can also find me on Facebook or on Twitters as MomToast_Mel or on Instagram as MomToast. Pretty much anywhere. If you search for MomToast, it's me. Because who else would call themselves that?
And I'm...
Oh, and we are now on YouTube.
Oh,
we have expanded.
That's also a MomToast thing. I'm featured...
He has a really cool song in honor of Game of Thrones. Y'all should listen to it. It's good.
Yes. It feels like Winter. A parody of Childish Gambino.
Yes. Which some of you may have no idea who that is, and that's okay. You don't need to know who that is to enjoy the song.
I think Melissa's aging herself.
I am old.
You might also know Mr. Gambino as Donald Glover from Community and Atlanta fame. But yes, in terms of our target audience, there might be people that might be like, well, I don't listen to R&B, but this is too white slash
Puerto
Rican that are adapting this for Game of Thrones fans. And it was a fun time. So yes, check that out. And we have a video version of our Native Son review up there as well now. So yes, check out all those things. Also, Cain and Abel on Amazon is my debut novel about somebody who grows up with a muscle weakness, wants to cure it, and kind of gets sidetracked by his vendetta against a...
Vengeance!
against a... you made me look dang it. But yeah, check it out. It's
read
on
the book.
Audible.
It's good.
And Kindle and print for your enjoying pleasure. All right, we're about to go to sleep, so
yes.
Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you later.
Bye.